unemployment claims are down overall, but surging in some places. From Marketplace in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. 1.31 million people filed for unemployment last week. It's a slight improvement. But if you dive into the numbers, things get murky. Diane Swonk is chief economist at tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton. Good morning.
Good morning.
So 1.31 million people claiming unemployment benefits. That's 100,000 less than the week before. Is that an improvement?
Well, it's not as much an improvement because we also have to include those special pandemic claims out there, which were approved by Congress. There's a lot of muddled data in the state data. It looks like they're still trending up, so it's difficult to tease it out. The most important thing to look at is the most recent week we saw big increases in some of the states with the biggest cases of COVID cases. States like Texas in the week ending the 4th of July had an increase of over 20,000. Then you see states like Nevada, Tennessee, Louisiana, all with much bigger numbers than they had. So they're going in the wrong direction in those places.
Several Federal Reserve Bank presidents have come out in recent days, some of them warning about what they call air pockets in the recovery, soft spots. What do you make of that given the numbers we've just seen?
Well, what's important about it is the Federal Reserve is not only looking at these numbers, they're looking at a lot of big data, which is this sort of weekly data we get on everything from customer traffic to credit card receipts, and all of that shows the same picture, a sharp slowdown after a recovery that it's come off those highs in recent weeks as the number of COVID cases have surged. What's interesting about it is the contagion of fear among consumers. It's not just in the worst affected COVID counties, as we saw at the onset of the crisis, but it's also in those areas that have been to the brink and back, like New York.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at the tax and advisory firm Grant Thornton. Thank you so much, as always, for the context.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that the Constitution does not, as the White House claimed, give the president absolute immunity from state criminal investigation. That means New York prosecutors may see the president's financial records, both personal and business. Richard Painter is law professor at the University of Minnesota and was a chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush.
Well, that there's no presumption in favor of the president being able to withhold his personal financial records from a state grand jury subpoena. Now, this does not mean that the records become public anytime soon. This is a grand jury subpoena issued by a New York State grand jury that is investigating financial crimes that may involve the Trump Organization, whether it's a payoff for Stormy Daniels or other crimes. There's absolutely no argument for blocking it under Article 2 of the Constitution. This does not interfere with presidential powers. It's simply a subpoena of his private accountants for the Trump Organization in the state of New York.
Do you think that as a consequence of this decision, the public will ever see the president's financial records?
Well, it depends on what the New York grand jury decides to do. If the New York grand jury decides to proceed with criminal charges, there might very well be evidence introduced at trial. If the New York grand jury does not proceed with criminal charges, usually the proceedings of the grand jury are secret and the information would not be disclosed.
Richard Painter, law professor at the University of Minnesota, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Pat.
The pandemic has brought into relief long-standing economic inequalities in the United States, inequalities that have been growing over the past four decades. One example is the digital divide. Marketplace senior economics contributor Chris Farrell is asking the question, should the internet be treated like a utility? Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Let's talk about some examples of what unequal access means in practice. I mean, are we talking students who have to learn from home need good internet access to do that?
Yes. And, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. There's been lots of stories about how online learning wasn't realistic for far too many families. Let me give you another example. Internet access, critical for employment these days, and high-tech gear has allowed older Americans who have been isolated in their homes or assisted living center to stay in touch with their families and friends, and they can order more safely goods and services online, again, assuming that they can.
So the idea is broadband is not a luxury. It's fundamental to participating in our economy.
Yeah, and I think the right historic analogy is electricity. You know, before the Great Depression, many rural areas weren't wired. You know, they were too remote, too few people, it was too expensive. And doesn't that sound familiar? Well, the New Deal brought electricity to rural areas for the first time. Turning digital access into utility, I think, is just a major step toward increasing the odds that those who've been hardest hit during these difficult times can participate in the economy as it gets better.
So, I mean, when something becomes utility, like what does that do? What changes? How does that make it more accessible to people?
It's a recognition, one, that it's a basic input into both domestic economic life, and the utility is a service. It's a physical network that everybody has access to. So right now, there is competition among private sector companies to provide broadband, but if it's too expensive to provide it in a particular community or a particular neighborhood, a particular area, it doesn't show up. When it becomes a utility, that is no longer acceptable.
Even if everyone did have good internet access, wouldn't there still be a divide because you need good computers to use it?
Yeah, and of course, the broadband also has to be affordable. You have to have high-quality, reliable broadband to participate in this economy. Then there are also going to be subsidies in terms of computers, support, training. No question about that. And by the way, big service providers, they aren't going to like this idea. But I still think that this is a critical step for an economy that as we emerge from this pandemic recession, it shouldn't be like the old one. It should be better.
Marketplace senior economics contributor Chris Farrell, thank you as always.
Thanks a lot.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.